powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy
on Seattle Sports Station.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union. Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. The GM Journey is a podcast hosted by former Falcons executive Thomas Dimitroff and his guest this week, none other than Seahawks GM John Schneider. John Schneider talked about his relationship with Pete Carroll, past drafts, his philosophy heading into drafts. It's a really, really fascinating conversation that obviously we're not going to play in full, but we do have some highlights for you guys because they're the cuts and the moments that stuck with us after listening to this interview. Two in particular, I cannot stop thinking about, but let's go over all of them. Here's John Schneider talking about how he and Carroll have treated their professional relationship.
When we got together, he was basically like, you know, I want this to be the best marriage that it can be, right? So, you know, that's like, right? I mean, marriage is an everyday negotiation. And so we have our periods where, you know, we try to have fun, because we're going to be working our tails off no matter what. And then, you know, not let people necessarily see, like, you know, the conflict. We kind of, you know, we can keep it separate. And then we're just both like-minded in the fact that, like, okay, what are we doing to get better?
Schneider and Carroll have one of the more fascinating GM coach kind of relationships in all of football because Pete Carroll has so much decision-making power. So it really has to have been a marriage for the two of them to work hand in hand as they help construct this team. They've done great things, and then now they've found themselves trying to rebuild back to that. It's just an interesting fork in the road for these two, but also an interesting relationship they've had to have compared to other GMs and head coaches.
Correct. It's very unique. There's no question about that. And one of the ways that it can quickly go south is that you have a power struggle, you know, within the power dynamic of what is typical. Typical is GM is the boss of the head coach. That is the normal power dynamic in the NFL. And I think that, you know, when that is flipped here, like it is in Seattle to a degree, you have to be mindful of the idea that not only, you know, how does the veto card get used in certain situations? That's what everybody would like to know. But more importantly, how you allow each person to focus on their area of expertise and allow them to grow and allow them to make those decisions and go through their process without being overbearing, without, you know, stepping on each other's toes. And I'm sure that there has been moments where that has happened, mm-hmm. right? And that's why I think John Schneider is talking about this being a marriage, right? That there is importance in this, that you compromise, you work together, you try to approach this every single day like you're going to, you know, make it the best day. But also when things are tough, that you are able to work through those problems and that you're committed to each other to work through those problems rather than, you know, staying bitter and angry and then looking for opportunities to get rid of one another. Like that is where things go south in a hurry in the NFL, and you see it happen all the time.
John Schneider also talked about their philosophy and approach to this year's draft class, which received a ton of praise compared to previous classes. Here's what he had to say.
This year, we only had three picks, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was like, okay, we got to nail the people, guys, like, because, mm-hmm. you know, I personally didn't think it was going to be, you know, with COVID and everything, I thought the draft was going to be just all over the place, right? And we weren't going to have the tools that we've had in the past. So I knew we weren't going to be moving around necessarily because our board didn't look that great. So the person, right, like really got into that, guys. We got to know who the person is. And in the past, to your point, we've, you know, taken the talent mm-hmm. over the core. Like, who is the guy? Who's the person? And that's kind of, that's what we try to keep coming back to.
And that was him talking about the, 2021 draft class when they had just three picks. But if you're looking at it, what I was trying to think of examples that he might be alluding to of when they took talent over person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they've drafted guys that have had some red flags, certainly. I mean, Malik McDowell is one that a lot of people point to.
Most notably,
who obviously was talented and obviously got into a freak accident, but had red flags pre-existing before that accident where he dropped because of that. But I couldn't really – I was racking my mind trying to think of potential players, because in all of his answers, he doesn't say any players by name, obviously.
Correct, of course.
Trying to think of, like, where did they stray from this? Because I have always felt like I've covered every draft, and I've always felt like in those post-draft press conferences, they've always talked about wanting a culture fit. And it seems like they've always prioritized that.
100%, but also that they've stepped out on that, you know, a few times. I mean, Frank Clark wasn't somebody that came in when they drafted him and had this glowing, you know, off the field reputation. Actually, you know, the Seahawks drew a lot of criticism for, you know, drafting Frank Clark and his, you know, his investigation at the time in terms of, you know, domestic violence and all of that, or I think it was assault. I can't remember. I don't want to do that injustice. But just remembering off the top of my head, it certainly was not a positive situation at all. But they took a chance on Frank Clark, and they felt like they could get the most out of him, and they certainly were able to do that. But I have to imagine that the person that they're looking at is Malik McDowell, that there were a lot of red flags around the individual, around the person, and it really bit them, you know, in the long run.
So related to trying to figure out what player he's talking about, there are two cuts that are going viral, at least in the Seahawks community on Twitter. I'm going to play those two right now. One's a bit longer, so I'm going to play that one first. This is John Schneider talking about whether or not coaching staffs ever influence GM decisions. And he says, yes, one time I was convinced to pass on the most competitive player in the draft, see if he regrets it or not.
And, you know, competition's the, you know, the theme, what you went through, all the stuff that Dan had, right?
Yes.
The exact same thing. Competition is the primary theme of our mm-hmm. operation, right?
Yeah.
And we passed, I can't give you the year, sorry, but we passed on the guy that we felt was the most competitive player in the draft. You know, and we passed on him for, hey, we're going to take a guy and this is how we're going to use him. And it's going to be unbelievable, to your point. Mm-hmm. You know, this is how we're going to use him, John. And I'm like, wow, that sounds phenomenal. So, you know, I had these whispers, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, hey, all right, well, shoot, we can have that player on the field at the same time. That's going to be amazing. Well, you know, getting back to like showing up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who's going to show up? The guy that is what everybody is viewed in that room as the top competitor in his position in the draft, we passed on. And now we get to a point where, to your point, like we're never doing that again. Nope.
That's a perfect example of me having listened to this interview and feeling like I left with even greater questions that I know I will never get an answer to.
Right.
Who was the coach?
Just say TJ Watt.
Just say,
John Schneider.
Exactly, because here's the thing.
Just
he's clearly talking about...
You think that's who it is?
Well, he says to have these two players on the field at the same time. You're talking about wide receivers. You're talking about defensive ends or defensive linemen. Or maybe you're talking about defensive backs.
Uh-huh.
Like, what players would be playing in a tandem?
Well, then he was like, you know, talked about, oh, this guy's going to show up because he's competitive. Malik McDowell didn't. He never showed up.
Quite literally.
Yeah, like he obviously.
You think
there
he's
was
talking
a medical
about passing on.
Emergency that kept
yes.
him away, but I think had he been able to get his head on straight after that, we probably would have ended up seeing him in a Seahawks
uniform. You think he's talking about wanting to take T.J. Watt and then passing on him because a coach somewhere made the very convincing argument about how to use Malik McDowell?
Yes.
I mean, it definitely could.
Unequivocally.
It could be that.
Who is the coach?
It could be that.
It
could be. There's also,
coach.
Guys, look, the 2017 draft class was, I mean, that was a doozy, right? So there is a number of circumstances that you could point to. I mean, Malik McDowell, there was T.J. Watt that was in there. There was Buda Baker that was also in that realm as well. I mean, there were a lot of good players. There's a lot of good players that were in that late round area that they traded back from and also sprinkled in the second round where they definitely could have had any one of those players. So I don't know if you could pinpoint exactly. Maybe it is T.J. Watt. But the point is that this does happen. Also, you know, there's been, you know, conversations and things that have been floated around about Nick Chubb and Rashad Penny, that coach's decision and influence, you know, made the Seahawks go with Rashad Penny over Nick Chubb, rather than John Schneider and what the scouting staff and everyone else kind of was thinking in terms of drafting Nick Chubb. So I think that this does happen. It happens more times than you think. But also, if you're a GM, you're trying to have the coaching staff involved. You want them involved. You want to be connected with what they're saying and how they think so that you can best acquire the talent that fits their respective schemes and how they coach things. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that's where it becomes tricky in this dynamic between Pete Carroll and John Schneider is how do you maneuver this and at what times does the coach come in and step in on the toes of a GM who's in the scouting department that's done all this work and everything else and has a conviction about a certain player and vice versa. So this is why it's been really fascinating watching Pete Carroll and John Schneider do their thing and do it successfully for the past 12 years.
We don't know. He'll never say it. Let's say hypothetically he's talking about the 2017 class. In the roster, you have Frank Clark, and then you have an aging Michael Bennett, and then obviously you have Jaron Reed, who's still young on the inside, and then what ended up being a short-term relationship with Sheldon Richardson, who I think they actually acquired after the draft. That was in like September or something. So you acquire Sheldon Richardson as a result of the Malik McDowell thing not working out. It's got to be McDowell, right? I'm looking at the class. If you say getting these two guys on the field at the same time, I am assuming it is a wide receiver, a defensive back, or a defensive lineman.
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be. And I'm trying to play skeptic over here with what right. Curtis is saying, but I think he's dead on in his assessment about TJ.
So that's the first of two viral clips where it's like, an unnamed coach convince him to pass on? And obviously it's a decision that he since regretted. Here's another cut that's making the rounds. This is him, again, talking about an unnamed player and how something that they did with this trade ended up being a huge mistake.
And then from, like the bigger trades we've made, we traded for an individual and made him the highest paid player on our team. I would never, ever do that again. Just didn't know it philosophically at the time what we were doing. I mean, we knew what we were doing, but not we should have known better.
He talked about taking a guy in and immediately making him the highest paid player on the team without maybe realizing whether or not he was fit for you.
Yeah, and that to me, obviously, that is one of the great mistakes that they made.
Percy Harvin. I think we're all talking about Percy Harvin.
Yes, he's 100% talking about Percy Harvin. Now, you could definitely apply that to a current player who they had most recently traded for and signed and made the highest paid player, which is Jamal Adams, right? I mean, you hear that conversation about Percy Harvin and you go, well, this hasn't necessarily been a splash here with Jamal Adams either, but I don't think that there's anybody on this team different from that time, different with Jamal Adams right now, where there's anybody on the team looking at Jamal Adams and going, why did this guy get paid more than me? Why did that happen? I don't think that was the culture of the team at the time. With Percy Harvin, it absolutely was. I mean, Doug Baldwin, Jermaine Kearse, Golden Tate, they all felt some type of way about that decision with Percy Harvin. And Percy obviously not even doing anywhere near the same contribution that those guys did to help them, win games and get to Super Bowls and things of that nature. So I think that is one of those moments that I'm sure you look back on and go, man, we really, really didn't, do a great job on that one.
I think what I find interesting about the Percy Harvin thing is I wonder if trading for him and immediately paying him a ton of money and then finding that he wasn't a fit did influence their decisions with Jamal Adams and opting to wait and then give him that extension. Like, I could see that impacting the decision. To me, the bigger fit with Jamal Adams is almost more like a Jimmy Graham. John Schneider's not talking about Jimmy Graham here, but in terms of fit, in terms of making you get the most of a guy, that to me is the more interesting comparison than the Percy Harvin one, because they did make Jamal Adams right now is the highest paid player on the team without Bobby Wagner and Russell Wilson there.
Yeah.
And he better be the face of your franchise. He better be a phenomenal player and all of that. But to me, they learned a lesson from the Percy Harvin trade. But I wonder if lessons were learned as much from the Jimmy Graham trade, because that to me is when I look at Jamal Adams and say, use this guy. Like, what does he do best? Do that. Otherwise, right. You know what I mean? Otherwise,
yes.
What are you doing?
Right. Well, and this is the classic case of, you know, when you make these types of trades, it's more, to me, it's more similar to Jimmy Graham than it is Percy Harvin, right? With Jamal Adams.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So you have to be able to, in this context, take it in two different ways. Either this player is such a great fit to our current scheme that it's a plug-and-play situation and we just go and it works so well for us, right? It fits exactly what we want to do. Or you're saying, look at this dynamic, unique player who does something that nobody else does in this league, and we feel like we are creative enough that we have the group, the brain trust that can put Jamal Adams in these unique situations and allow him to be that type of player. We're not going to try to make him anybody different, mm-hmm. right? We're going to allow Jamal Adams to be Jamal Adams, and we're going to be creative with how we do it, and we're going to change our defense around him. And so far, at least last year, that's not the approach that they took, and that's where, you know, this whole thing goes awry, the same, very similar to how it was with Jimmy Graham.
All right, let's get a four-down territory.
This is four-down territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really
All right, we've got to be quick with these. First down, what have the Seahawks emphasized in OTAs that you believe will be beneficial long-term?
Well, what I believe will be beneficial long-term is taking the time to make sure that you're teaching your principles, that you are teaching the offense and defensive scheme, that you're not worried about at this point right now going full go 11 on 11. Yes, you could talk about, you know, trying to maintain the health of these players, but also I believe that they have so many new young players that they're trying to get up to speed, that they are slowing this thing down to the point where they can really dive into the fundamental X's and O's conversations that are required for you to truly become an expert, Stacey, an expert with your jobs and assignments. And maybe over the last 4 years, you've taken for granted of the fact that you don't have the Legion of Boom. You don't have these guys that not only were exceptional talents, but were unbelievable masters of their positions. And expecting these guys to do the same thing that those players did. And recognizing, no, we need to start from scratch. We need to start truly from day one, and we need to get everyone caught up to speed so everyone feels like they know the smallest little details of their position, of their craft, and how it all fits together within your respective schemes. And that way, when you get to training camp, you really feel like you're hitting the ground running. I think that has been a very smart move by this organization because you have so many new and young players.
Second down. Deshaun Watson suspended for any time this season. Does it take Baker Mayfield out of the conversation for Seattle?
I don't believe it should. Regardless of whether Deshaun Watson plays this year, they should not be going back to Baker Mayfield. They signed Jacoby Brissett. They signed Joshua Dobbs. Now, I'm not saying Josh Dobbs is better than Baker Mayfield, but you clearly already had a plan for how you were going to move on with life after Baker Mayfield. And if I'm Baker Mayfield, I don't care if it means sitting out, you know, some time. I'm not returning to that locker room. I'm not returning to that organization. I'm not doing them a favor after what they did in terms of going out and getting Deshaun Watson and kicking you to the curb, basically. Like, I am really shocked by how the Browns are operating, how they are handling this current situation. The best thing for the organization and for the team and for Baker Mayfield is for everyone to part ways and to separate. But I don't know if the Cleveland Browns think that Baker Mayfield is this insurance policy that they can hold on to. I just think it's a massive mistake. And Jacoby Brissett is the guy that should take over if Deshaun Watson is not able to play. He is a proven veteran in this league. He's not a dynamic guy, but you have enough talent that you could win around him.
Third down. Of the Seahawks who have not been at the facility yet, who do you believe the coaching staff is most excited to see return?
Well, I have to imagine Quandre Diggs is going to be a guy that they would love to have back in the building in terms of his leadership, his everyday approach, the energy that he brings. You know, Stacey, there were, you know, for the most part, everybody participated in OTAs when the Seahawks were going, you know, in 16, 17 and being around that crew. And everybody brought the energy and everything else. But I'm telling you, there was just a different air to when Michael Bennett stepped in the room. There was just this missing element that you didn't know was missing until he was there. And you're like, oh, okay, now things are for real. Not that Michael Bennett was the overarching leader, but that he brought this other dynamic to the team that just really made everything gel and mesh and come together, and you just felt like you had the whole team together at that point. And so when you're missing Jamal Adams, DK Metcalf, Quandre Diggs, Al Woods, you know, some of the other veterans, you are missing that presence for these young guys to be around, and that different energy. And so the guys that I have to imagine that the Seahawks are excited and thrilled to have back for mandatory minicamp, number one, Quandre Diggs, and then closely behind that, Jamal Adams and DK Metcalf, because they set an entirely different tone.
Fourth down. Now, this, of course, previews a story that we have coming up in the timeline, so without adding too much additional context, fourth down, Jake, have you ever said something that you immediately regretted because the situation became painfully or intensely awkward?
No, but I will tell you.
Never?
I will tell you.
Didn't you tell me about something you said about Brooke when Brooke was in labor and you said something?
Oh, no.
No. I said I would never say something like
that.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, but I have been in the room when someone else went up to or saw a woman and said, "How when are you due?"
I was in the room
when someone mistaken a woman's appearance as being pregnant when they were not pregnant.
And it was the most cringeworthy situation. Why do that?
I have ever been. I don't know why people do that.
I genuinely don't understand.
If you don't know, don't say anything. Let them tell you.
Also, unless it is so incredibly obvious that a woman is pregnant, where it's like there is a baby inside of her, and this is basically the outline of the baby.
You can literally
see the baby waving at you from underneath her. Don't say anything. I find it like just kind of weird. Maybe it's just being a woman, but like how people broach social norms when they realize a woman is pregnant,
uh-huh.
and all of a sudden it's like, "Can I touch your belly?
That's so weird.
Yeah,
can I talk to you about babies?" And it's like, I don't understand. I've never been pregnant. I've just had this happen to a million friends, where it's like, all of a sudden people drop all social niceties when they find out someone's pregnant, and they decide that it's totally okay to like
invade their personal privacy.
And I think what happens is that being a parent and being a mother is this weird connection that people can make with each other, where you just intrinsically now understand something, the two of you.
Correct.
But that being said, if someone's a stranger, first of all, never ask someone, "When are you due?"
if you don't know them, and you don't know it's actually happening, I just don't get it. Where's the win?
Oh,
where is the win?
I know.
There's none.
It's Jake and Stacey. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and the Seattle Sports app. Well, speaking of saying things that make situations painfully awkward, Carlos Beltran had one of those yesterday. I'll tell you what happened next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
This is The Timeline on Jake and Stacey. This hour brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. I mentioned earlier, Jake, hey, have you ever been in a moment where you said something and it then made the situation painfully or uncomfortably awkward? And you said you couldn't think of anything. I think that there has to be a moment. Like, I refuse to believe this. I think there has to be a moment where that happened. But I digress. Your example was watching someone in real life go up to a stranger, a woman, and say, "When are you due?" when she was not pregnant. And that we got plenty of responses from people saying, "Yep, seen that before," and it is painfully uncomfortable. So, adding to this, in the sports world, Yankees color analyst Carlos Beltran did not see the irony in him really wanting to know what pitches the opposing team was throwing.
You know, and if you could find something that you could take advantage and use it to put your team in a position to win, you're going to do it.
Now, would you keep this information for yourself, or would you give it to your teammates too?
I share my information. I want everyone to have success. You know what? A lot of times, some guys, they like it. Sometimes they say, "You know what? I don't want to know." I get anxious. I say, "You don't want to know? I want to know what's coming." You know, like, that will put me in a position for me to feel good at the plate.
Yikes. That obviously stemming from the Houston Astros cheating scandal. And garbage banging scandal, the implication there that people, I'm sure, listening, and then certainly people in the booth being like, "Hey, man, stop saying this. You guys are really lucky." fuck, you got away with that one.
Yeah. I mean, dude. Like, dude.
Of course, why wouldn't you want to know what pitch was coming? I would want that information, and I would share it with my teammates. And it's like, how many times do we have to watch people who were with that organization or who were part of that organization cheating basically tell the world what they did without any real punishment?
And also, they're like, and Beltran, I would share that information with my teammates. I want them to know. And if they said they didn't want to know that, basically he would laugh at them. You know, like, how you don't want to know? How would you not want to know? This to me is, if I'm Rob Manfred, if I'm Major League Baseball, I'm looking at Beltran and I'm going, what are you doing to me?
Please stop.
What are you doing to us? This is already bad enough as it is. We get so much flack for what we did not do to come down harsher on you guys. And you're sitting up here post-player, you know, having this nice little interview because your name has not been tarred and feathered and been, you know, thrown in the gutter of Major League Baseball. We protected you, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then you're going out and bragging about wanting to go out and steal signs.
It's also just really painful because you're talking about it in this abstract way when everyone hearing it is connecting it to Houston, saying like, oh, I bet you did want to know.
It's like
I
that.
Bet you did.
It's like that meme of Leonardo DiCaprio on the couch just pointing up. He's like,
yeah.
What?
Hey!
Hey!
Me!
I recognize that.
I cannot wait until there's been enough time that's passed since the Astros cheating scandal when either enough former players or people within that organization want to talk about it, or when it's just there's no players union that they can turn to and say, I'm being unfairly suspended, and like we finally get the full, because I bet it's even worse than we think. I bet it goes further than we think.
No question it does. No question. No question. And that's why to this day, it will still be a topic that even like 30 years from now will always get me fired up, because I still can't believe that they got away with it in the manner that they did.
I'm very interested to see in how Hall of Fame voters will treat Astros players of mm-hmm. this era. And Carlos Beltran, I believe his first year on the ballot is next year. And he had Hall of Fame type numbers. Mm-hmm. One of the best switch hitters of all time. Was an MVP candidate a lot of times, but he was heavily involved in what the Astros did in 2017.
But what do you mean, though, Curtis? Like, how will they treat them any other way?
Well, this is what's always been interesting.
Scandal attached to their name. There's no real genuine punishment to their name.
No, you're right. And this is what's always been fascinating about the Astros and that cheating scandal is they probably could have won a World Series without doing it. And that's what makes... No, you did it. You did it, and it wasn't fair, and you don't deserve that. You do not deserve that World Series title simply because you cheated the way that you did and as extensively as you did.
Yeah.
However, what makes all those Hall of Fame, Curtis, those cases interesting is that plenty of these guys, it's like, yeah, you are good enough. You are good enough to be in the Hall of Fame, but now this is with you forever. But, like, you take that away, you were probably still good enough, and you'd still be a Hall of Famer.
It just blows my mind. But Curtis, so you think that the baseball voters could take justice into their own hands? Is that what you're wondering here?
I think so. I think they've done that with a lot of guys who were named on like the Mitchell Report and guys who have had steroid, you know, whispers about their careers. I think they have definitely done that. And look, some writers may feel slighted that the Astros got away with what they got away with in 2017, being like, you know what? I'm going to take this into my own hands. Carlos Beltran, you're not getting a vote. When Jose Altuve mm-hmm. retires, he's not getting a vote.
Yeah. They'll still
Bregman,
get in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't even know if Altuve or Bregman are locks to get in. I think Carlos Beltran had the strongest Hall of Fame mm-hmm. case of all of these guys. But I don't know now if it's a for sure thing. He may have to wait a few years before getting in.
All right. Next up in the timeline.
I hope so.
22 lucky or maybe unlucky golf fans will get to watch this weekend's RBC Canadian Open from a crane suspended above the golf course. The seats will go up to 100 feet in the air. 22 people will be strapped in while they enjoy food and beverage for 30 minutes above the first and 18th holes.
Why?
For fun.
Why?
Because it's a view no one else has.
This makes no sense.
For the thrill of it. Because it's a once in a lifetime experience. You don't want to be suspended in a crane 100 feet in the air.
No, I don't.
I don't know why not.
And also, I don't want to have to be strapped in, enjoy food or beverage, get used to the view, and then have to come down. You're only up there for 30 minutes. You know how much money you're probably paying to be a part of that experience? For an hour?
For an hour.
How tall is 100
But it said pre and.
Oh, yeah.
So it said the beginning.
100 feet in the air. I believe that's, what, 10 stories? Because isn't a story 10 feet?
Yeah, I was trying to think of, like, an equivalent to that. So I was thinking of, like, any kind of buildings. And it's like, well, no, that would be, like, the.
I'd say it's probably maybe, like, the top of T-Mobile Park.
Oh, God.
There is no way that that is an enjoyable viewing experience. There's no way.
No,
what do you
can't
what,
see anything.
What do you see?
And you probably got golf balls whizzing by your head.
This is one of the dumbest ideas I've ever seen.
Would you do it?
No.
No.
No,
would
I would
you
not.
Would you get paid to do it? How much would someone have to pay you? How much would someone have to pay
this
you?
This isn't something that I'm fearful
to get paid?
Of.
$100
Yeah, probably.
Gift card.
Bucks.
Yeah, you got a gift card to Amazon. I'm there.
This isn't something that I'm fearful of doing. This is something that I think is a giant waste of time. It's a giant waste of time. I'd rather spend more. I'd rather take that money and spend it on, you know, getting some VIP, you know, tickets in the normal seating area than going up in a crane for 30 minutes. That's ridiculous.
Now,
that's absurd.
The 360 asks a fair question. What happens if I drop my fork? That fork becomes a weapon.
Yeah. So I researched just Googling height of T-Mobile Park. The roof at T-Mobile Park is 215 feet above the playing field. So half of that is 100 feet. So like,
and you're
the second,
suspended in a crane.
The like, second I level, I guess.
I can't stress enough. It's not like you're – it's not like watching off of a balcony. The picture that they have – I don't know if this is what they plan, but the picture they have looks like a fair ride. Like you're kind of – you're strapped in. You're sitting down. But like there is no wall. You know what I mean? Like all around you is just air. And there's like a, like obviously a little ceiling or a floor that you guys are all sitting on. But like this isn't looking over a balcony. This is being suspended.
This is
100 feet above the first and 18th
This
poles.
Is unbelievable. Unbelievable. This is people who have money that just it's expendable. And it's like, yeah, why not? Why not? Let's do this.
Yeah.
Would you do this?
Yeah.
You would?
Yeah.
You, of course you would.
Well, it depends on the food.
It's a status thing.
It's a status. I would take so many pictures. Influencer. It's Jake and Stacey. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and the Seattle Sports app. Earlier, we talked about who the face of the franchise is for the Seahawks now without Bobby Wagner and Russell Wilson. But I want to move it forward. What makes someone the face of a franchise? That's next.
Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On Seattle Sports Station.
Here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
What makes somebody the face of a franchise? 206-421-3776. I'm moving this conversation forward from this. There was an article published over the weekend in the Seattle Times. Larry Stone, friend of the show, he's a columnist that covers all local sports here in Seattle, and he wrote, who is the next face of the franchise for the Seahawks? It was a really great read, and what I liked about it is one part in particular where he talked about, you know, like, hey, some people might hear it and think, like, who cares? But he said the fact that no one definitively comes to mind speaks to the reality that this is a Seattle team in transition, awaiting the emergence of new stars. Now, there are a lot of really exciting parts to that, right? Like,
yeah.
as stressful as it is to head into a season without a sure thing at quarterback and wondering what your team is going to look like, and after 10 years of winning, wondering if you're even going to make the playoffs, as stressful as all that is, you have so many young stars that you think, what if you're seeing the beginning of something too, right? There's a silver lining to a kind of rebuild. So who's the face of the franchise moving forward? You and I got into this debate and you were talking about, well, you know, it's about stardom, but it's also about leadership. And maybe sometimes those can be two different things and sometimes they're the same thing. So
right.
Because we got into a debate about it, I wanted to kind of move this back to here. So I said, what does it mean then? Forget who the face of the franchise is, because most people said DK or Tyler Lockett were the two most popular responses.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to be the face of a franchise? Like, what is a face of the franchise? So this from one listener, 206-421-3776, to join this conversation. This person said, what makes someone the face of the franchise is the person everyone is tuning in to watch. Jerseys are selling, tickets are selling to see this person. Right now, the Seahawks don't have that one guy under contract that tilts the scales in his direction. DK has the potential, along with many others on the team, but they do not have at this point anyone who has emerged as that guy with the it factor. That's what this listener said. Now, I think that DK, again, is really close to being that guy. And I think I do think DK sells jerseys. I think DK sells tickets. I think when I talk to like, I don't frequently talk to teenagers, but when I hear from young people about who their favorite Seahawks are, it's always DK Metcalf. Like, he, I think that there is a new generation of Seahawks fans that adore DK Metcalf. They think he's the coolest guy on the planet.
Absolutely.
But is he the face of the franchise? Right now, yeah, but I don't know. Let's move the conversation forward.
I would say so. Yes, he is the number one reason why you're tuning in to watch the Seahawks.
But is that what being a face of the franchise is to you?
No.
Okay.
That's not what being the face of the franchise is to me. Being the face of the franchise means a little bit more. Maybe this is the quarterback in me that's talking, but when you're the face of the franchise, you have the responsibility. Not only is it an outward projection of you know, hey, here's one of our better players on the team or our best player on the team, but who has the responsibility and the trust of the organization to be the representative that they are pushing out there, that they want to take that spotlight, right? It was, you know, a number of guys during the Legion of Boom era that had the spotlight and just it was a life of its own. For the second era of the Pete Carroll and John Schneider era, it was two guys very, very clearly. It was Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner that not only were they the best players and they were superstars in their own right, but they were also the two guys that this organization wanted to be the forward-facing element of the organization, okay? From a leadership perspective, everything else, they embodied what a Seahawk was. That's what they wanted. And when I talk in that context, the two guys that stand out to me at the current moment, without seeing how the season is going to unfold
right now today,
and seeing who is going to step up and emerge as that superstar and as the true face of the franchise, the two guys that I see that the organization is trying to push out there in front of everybody is Tyler Lockett and Quandre Diggs, and make it very clear and very obvious that these two guys represent exactly who we want and what we expect our Seahawk players to be. They are the embodiment of what a Seahawk is. That, to me, is what is very clear at the current moment, knowing and wanting Daryl Taylor, Jordan Brooks, DK Metcalf, Jamal Adams, right? A number of other guys, maybe Charles Cross or Abraham Lucas or Ken Walker, that there's other players that step up and are candidates to be able to take on that mantle. But right now, I think stability-wise, those are the two guys that are your forward-facing, you know, guys of your franchise.
I guess I just separate face of the franchise. It's almost like a local definition versus a national definition. And the national definition might not matter to you, but that ultimately sometimes tells you about where your team is.
Yeah.
For instance, locally, we've always felt that Tyler Lockett is an exceptional leader on the team, an exceptional player, but he hasn't gotten as much national recognition. I mean, he's a top 10, you know, wide receiver in terms of, you know, either total yardage or touchdowns often, maybe just outside the top 10, and certainly in fantasy circles. Larry points this out in his article, is certainly well known, but like, he's not, you know, the biggest, but he's not Davante Adams, like a guy that people constantly just look at and think like, that guy. So to me, there's a local way to look at it where you're like, Tyler Lockett, absolutely that guy.
Yeah.
But is the face of the franchise defined by people outside of that? Is the face of the franchise defined by other people? Because I don't know that people outside of Seattle look at Seattle and say, Tyler Lockett. Not that I don't think he's a great leader.
They don't.
One of the better leaders on this team, but that's how I look at it.
Every single preview of, you know, Seahawks versus
I am telling you right now,
Denver Broncos or Seahawks versus anybody, it's DK Metcalf.
Or week one, it might be Pete Carroll's face too.
He is the clear national attraction. Okay, so from that perspective, DK Metcalf is your most visible player on this team.
Yes.
Hands down, it's not even close. It's not even close. No debate. No close. Not close. Okay? But in terms of the actual faces of the franchise that I think that the organization is trying to project and put out there, as of right now, I do think it's Tyler Lockett and Quandre Diggs because they're the two most senior veteran players that also have the combination of veteran element that have been within the program and have had tremendous success within the program. Like, to me, those are the clear and obvious choices. Not saying that those are going to be the final names. I think Quandre Diggs will remain one of those guys. But there are a number of different candidates that can explode onto the scene and take on that mantle.
From the 253, Jake, why not Drew Lock? Would that not be the logical choice? Now, I think the face of the franchise for many teams is the quarterback.
No.
But honestly, what has
Drew
Lock
no.
done? Well, that's what I'm saying. What has Drew Lock done to make him, outside of being the quarterback, outside of being a quarterback, what has Drew Lock done to make him a face of a franchise over DK, over Quandre?
Holding up to the camera, a big zero, goose egg, nothing. He has done nothing up to this point. And it's not just the position.
Like, you don't just get it handed to you unless you're a number one overall pick.
He also,
like, Trevor Lawrence hasn't proven it, but he was a number one overall pick.
Also, he doesn't even have the job right now. He's in a competition with Geno Smith, and it's a very legitimate competition. It's not a fake competition. It's a legit competition. So if there was anybody, if you're talking about anybody from the quarterback room that actually has leadership capital right now, it's Geno Smith at the current moment, over everybody else.
From Fred in Birch Bay, if quarterback is not the face of the franchise, you have a problem. Now, Fred, most of the time I agree with you. There are a few exceptions, though. Again, I think Aaron Donald is the face of the franchise for the Rams. Matthew Stafford is a very good quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think Rams, and when I think a lot of people think Rams, they think Aaron Donald.
Yes.
So it depends. Overwhelmingly, though, I do think the quarterback and face of the franchise typically goes hand in hand, but you still got to kind of earn the role. And if there is a superstar on your team that is so clearly dominant and one of the most dominant players in the league, it's going to be that guy. It's why for a while, I think you could look at it and say in 2013, was it Russell Wilson or was it Richard Sherman who was the face of the franchise?
I mean, I would argue that maybe even Marshawn Lynch was probably the face of the franchise, right? So, I mean, there was a number of different guys you could point to.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. The Mariners wrap up their road trip with a series against the Houston Astros. First pitch for today's opener is at 5:10 p.m. Robbie Ray gets the start. It'll be right here on Seattle Sports Station. Pregame starts at 4 p.m. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company. Speaking of Mariners, we're going to jump back into that conversation. How can they wrap up this road trip with this series win? What needs to go right against the Astros, and who needs to step up to the plate, figuratively and literally? Jason Churchill joins us next. Don't go anywhere.